Welcome to the 38th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Jad.
Mahendra Singh Dhoni gambled India's cricketing fortunes on a turning pitch in Mumbai. Welcome to the podcast that always likes to live on the edge.
So this week we've got a roundup of all the cricket of the last fortnight, or at least the cricket that we've been interested in and think you should be interested in. We're going to be looking back at the career of Ricky Ponting and seeing how it was made in an Australian nightclub in 1999. We're going to be looking at Akash Chopra's Out of the Blue, debating the role of the millionaire cricketer, and finally we've got an interview with Samir Chopra of Crick Info's The Pitch.
And we've had an astonishing amount of Test cricket, and it's not just been quantity, it's been quality. And South Africa and Australia in the sort of battle for world number one have provided a series, well, certainly a run-filled series, but also a drama-filled series as well.
They have. It's been... I don't get to watch as much Test cricket as I would like. And when
the drawbacks of full-time employment.
Well, and there aren't many. Working for a charity, there aren't many perks either. But the moment that... I mean, usually when I get to watch Test cricket, I just watch reruns of 2005 Ashes on DVD. But the moment that I just watched and tears came to my eyes was in the first innings of this final Test between Australia and South Africa. And Stark bowled two balls for Australia. First defeat right at the beginning of the match, and they sort of set the tone. Seems a bit silly to say that now that Australia are on the verge of victory, but save for a punter triple century in his last match, of course. But Stark bowled two balls at the beginning, one to Peterson, and then one several balls later to Callis, which were just they were outswingers, full length outswingers that just held their line at the last minute and bowled both of them. And it was just, you know, when you just watch cricket and you sort of, you know, we spend our lives debating all kinds of things about cricket, but ultimately there is nothing more beautiful than just watching an absolute jaffer from a fast bowler.
Perfect. That's
just...
But it's interesting, isn't it? I suppose it's maybe something that cricket fans would divide over. What is more perfect, you know, a glorious cover dive or a glorious away swing? But it's funny, you could almost watch 5 days of a Test, and it may come down to those couple of moments that you remember. It's interesting from an English perspective, because a couple of these Aussie youngsters, and Stark being one of them, are quite a sort of scary prospect, especially when you go back to the last Ashes when the Australian lineup was so toothless bowling-wise. I mean, Stark looks like quite a prospect.
Ponting's retiring, and he is very much the last of the old guard, really. I mean, Hussey, sort of, but actually Hussey wasn't playing regularly Test cricket when Ponting and Hayden and the Wards were playing, for instance, and Warner and McGrath, Gillespie and the whole lot. And it actually gives you a bit of confidence.
But I mean,
we don't want confidence in Australia.
But they haven't, by the way, lost the series yet. But it's going to be extraordinary when they lose this series, because I feel like they've dominated it, and particularly Michael Clarke, who somehow metamorphosed into kind of a new Don Bradman, scoring double hundreds almost with ease. And yet they do seem like they're going to lose. It's been an extraordinary series.
Interesting. Over in India, you would think that the Indians are thinking exactly the same thing. The day in the first Test, and I remember, I now feel slightly foolish, because I tweeted after the first Test that England either needs to get a bit of incisiveness with the bat or a bit of incisiveness with the ball, but without both, and neither of which they seemed that they had, they were going to get absolutely thrashed throughout. And actually it seems that the main reason that they haven't been thrashed throughout, India have dominated. The main reason is Kevin Peterson, isn't it?
Well, I think this Kevin Peterson innings in Mumbai, I mean, I don't think there has ever been a better reason to get up at 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning. I set my alarm clock more in hope than in expectation. I thought, I'm not going to get up for this. I desperately put the feed on, sort of settled down to watch it.
Well, this and is
it
4 a.m. You got up at 4 a.m.
I got up at 4 a.m. I got up at 4 a.m. I ended up asleep. I'll be honest, I didn't quite last the Test. I ended up asleep. So, but this was extraordinary stuff. And I actually, while watching this, I thought, well, this is a truly great innings, and what makes it great is the fact that it's not just better than any other player could manage in this situation. It's at a level that the rest simply couldn't conceive of. I've got a huge respect for Alistair Cook and Che Pujara, the way they played, but these were ultimately defensive masterclasses from Cook and Pujara. They hung on in there, and I mean, both of them fantastic players. I mean, Cook particularly, the runs he's going to make in his Test career is stirring. But Peterson played a bold attacking innings on a pitch that other players could barely hang on
to. He did what we've always talked about, the sort of Adam Gilchrist figure being able to do, which is actually what Cook did was he went in and he sort of set a tone for the match and he sort of established the position. But what Peterson did was he changed the game, and that's something that's fairly rare.
It was a true match, and I think a lot of people made the point that he just didn't seem to be playing on the same pitch. I think this innings also laid to rest one myth pretty definitively: is we cannot mistake Kevin Peterson's brashness for stupidity. He's aggressive, he's arrogant, and frankly, according to a lot of reports, often quite unpleasant. But this is a very smart and committed professional cricketer, and he appears to have gone away after that first test and really sorted himself out.
Well, I think we should reserve judgment on that, because yes, he has had one test innings that has been very successful. But in this series against spinners on a turning pitch, he has repeatedly failed.
Yeah,
and the fact that he has had one innings that has been, yeah, absolutely, it was brilliant. There's no denying that at all. But you can't say suddenly that therefore all the times that he's failed we should sort of completely discount.
Sloppy, has been ordinary, has been poor. Some people would call it rubbish.
The sort of flip side of the whole thing is that England have won the second test against India. The series is 1-1. But that victory was founded on Alistair Kirk and Kevin Peterson being able to play spin. What is not the case is that suddenly England have worked out how to play spin. Everyone else, no one else made a big score.
I think that if you want to feel better as an Indian cricketer, Indian cricket fan at the moment, that's a very solid point to make. I mean, Stuart Broad had a torrid time of it as well. I mean, dismal time of it, frankly. But I guess what you would say is that to beat India on a turning track, to effectively outplay India at their own game, I mean, for England spinners in particular to outspin India spinners, I mean, it's one of those rare moments where you have to admit that Jeff Boycott talks a lot of sense, because he was going on about the fact our spinners are better than their spinners. And I kept thinking, no, Jeffrey, like, no. And they were. I mean, Monty and Swan and Panesar did things that the Indian spinners simply seemed unable to do.
They did, and I wonder whether it's... Whenever Panesar comes back into the Panesar's always, I mean, he's never been for a length of time England's established spinner. And there was the 2000 and I get England's Ashes victories mixed up now. They just come so often.
That's so regular.
But when he was preferred, when Jars was preferred instead of him, actually that was 2006, and we definitely did not win in 2006. Jars was preferred instead of him, and then he had a little spell when Jars retired. But then Swan came back, and so he's always been playing second fiddle. It's interesting that when Panesar comes back into the side, he actually repeatedly out bowls Swan. Yeah. And there's something about the fact that England's two-spin solution often seems to be more effective than England's one-spin solution.
Well, I think Panesar on a turning track basically rips the ball more than Swan does. And I think that he would get...
He bowls flatter. Well, this is the problem, exactly. In England, on a non-turning pitch, he doesn't put enough... He doesn't deceive batsmen in the air, which is what Swan does. He bowls it quicker, and he bowls it flatter, and so he gets more off the pitch. But when the pitch isn't turning, then not enough complement.
Yeah, and frankly, Swan looks a happier bowler, I think, bowling in tandem with Panesar. I'm certainly happier than he did in the first test. Yeah. From spin success to ultimate spin failure.
Yes.
Naught for 260 in 37 overs are figures enough to make any cricketer cry. Imran Tahir was actually cheered by the Aussie crowd when he was brought on in the second innings. I thought there was quite a touching moment where Russell Domingo, South Africa's assistant coach, couldn't think of anything to say to Tahir and just gave him a hug. I felt really sorry for Imran Tahir. He's got this incredibly tenuous career path from sort of Pakistan via England to South Africa international. And I think there's a lot of argument over cricket about these sort of adopted nationalities. But Tahir has worked really hard to get into the South African test side. And sadly, this is the kind of day that could have ended a career. It's really interesting, I think, for a club cricketer, and maybe heartening, to see a spin bowler, a leg spinner in particular, just suffer the itch.
It's not heartening. I bowl very, very occasional leg spin.
Well, apparently so does Imran Tahir.
My finest moment being hit for... I think I went for 42 off one over for the number of wides.
Is that
wides? Yeah, the number. There are a few wides in there, and a no ball or two. And seeing that the very best can't do it either, it sort of makes you give up hope.
I mean, I think there was one thing that I don't think was well reported enough here, particularly amongst the torrents of Twitter abuse that Tahir was receiving, is that he was genuinely very unfortunate here, because he was having one of those days where really, on a normal day, Graham Smith would have taken him out of the tack, let him lick his wounds, come back strong the next day. Sadly, the injury to Jack Callis meant he had to keep bowling. And you imagine this guy, out of form, Michael Clarke rampant, having to keep bowling. It was horrible. I mean, it was car crash viewing. The fascination I have here is whether Tahir will get a chance to put this right, or whether this will be a kind of the end of his cricketing.
Interestingly, South Africa have pinned quite a lot on him. They haven't had a really quality spinner for a while.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment.
With apologies to the various people who have imitated, mostly with off-spin, fairly quality spinners. And also there's been the nationality issue and the same kind of Hashim Amla is a quality batsman out and out, but he has become a sort of bit of a pin-up boy for the Muslim community in South Africa. I think the same thing has happened with Imran Tahir. So, I mean, it would certainly be very disappointing if one game sort of wrote off his entire career.
From the archives, and in the week when a true cricketing great, Ricky Ponting, retired, Toby is going to take us back to a moment in a nightclub when Ponting's career changed, and several other off-field moments that have determined the lives of the cricketing greats.
When thinking about the career of Ricky Ponting, he's one of my favourite cricketers, and there are so many interesting things to say about him, or things that I think are interesting anyway. But one of the things that I think is most interesting about him is his transformation from being a sort of tearaway young batsman, prodigiously talented, but not much of a team player. I mean, he was a little bit of a Kevin Peterson in his younger days.
In your language, I think that's the ultimate insult.
And now, 20 or so years later, when he comes to retirement, he is the ultimate part of the cricketing establishment. He is Steve Waugh reincarnated. And I think that the transformation from young tearaway to sort of cricketing establishment can be pinpointed to the night of the 25th of January 1999, when he was in a nightclub in Australia. He was caught brawling and he was banned for several matches and he was fined by the Australian Cricket Association. And what was interesting is that this proved a bit of a watershed. So nowadays, when the accusations against Peterson, for instance, were all very murky, no one was quite sure what happened. But what was really remarkable about Ponting here, and what I think has been really admirable about Ponting throughout his career, was his utmost honesty. He came out and he said, "I've got a problem with drink. I think it's going to interfere with my career if I go on like this." He actually also came out and said, "I want to be Australia captain," which for someone who's already part of the setup, is fair enough if you're sort of 18 and you come out and say that.
Yeah.
But when you're already part of the setup and come out and say that, it can sometimes come across as a little bit overly ambitious.
The interesting thing is you'd assume that at that point the media coverage was exactly how you've described it, tear away, a problem with alcohol, could not have been further from a captain. But actually you sometimes wonder whether that tear away streak isn't actually quite a natural, there's a natural development in a way from that sort of independence to the independence that a leader means. I'm not saying that an alcoholic would necessarily make a great leader, but I'm just saying the kind of person.
If you want to be a good leader, dear listeners, become an alcoholic. That is the worst map radio.
And brawl in nightclubs. But I mean, I think the idea, as a true leader, as a true captain, and actually, frankly, as a successful player, a lot of the really great players, it needs that independent streak, that sort of rebel streak.
It does, and this is slightly the problem that we come up against when talking about the career of Ricky Ponting, because there are just so many interesting things to talk about, one of which is exactly this issue.
So did he give up the alcohol?
The captain. Well, he certainly didn't. So there were several accusations beforehand about off-the-pitch incidents, one of which was when he was in India and he was accused of a little bit of indecent groping in a nightclub. And it certainly seems that this moment when suddenly, this moment in 1999 when it all came out into the open and the newspapers splashed it all over their front pages and he came out and he said, "Actually, do you know what, I think you're right. I think I do have a problem with alcohol and I think I do need to solve it." And 2 years later he became one day captain, succeeded Steve Waugh as one day captain, and the rest, as they say, is history. But I think what is very interesting is that when he retired, when he announced his retirement last week, he said, "I've dedicated 20 years to cricket." And I think the reason that he had been able to dedicate 20 years to cricket, and that it wasn't 20 years that was sort of jointly dedicated to alcohol, loose women and cricket, was because it all came out into the open, and there had to be a moment where he had to explicitly address the issue rather than letting it
And I suppose there are lots of prospects who never manage to turn that around, who have these issues off the pitch. But do you think there are those in Aussie cricket who deserve some respect for that? That, you know, Ponting made the turnaround himself, but there were people who didn't write this guy off. You know, do you think there's some respect deserved in
well,
that?
Well, I think... It's always that balance, and it's something that we've seen with Peterson quite a lot. It's that balance between raw talent and the ability to actually toe the line a bit. And when thinking about Ponting, it actually made me think about other incidents in cricket where players had sort of misbehaved. I mean, I sound like a schoolmaster when I say
I know, but with your misbehave and your groping and your brawling, it all sounds quite civilised.
Indecent acts. As one newspaper reported his shenanigans with women in a nightclub, indecent acts. Moving on. So it made me think about moments when cricketers when there were incidents with cricketers that
were... And
you're
particularly drawn to a certain rather portly former England
star. Well, yeah, I mean,
in
incidents where they weren't, like, where they weren't players brawling in the dressing room like Shahid Afridi or someone, you know, hitting fans as Inzamil Al-Haq famously did, but people who sort of had incidents that were in a sense outside cricket. And a very interesting one is Mike Gatting. And for Mike Gatting, it happened at a very different point in his career. So he had recently been established as England captain, and there was an accusation that he had been up to no good with a Leicester barmaid in a hotel room. I mean, you may laugh, but...
It's just not the most glamorous of affairs, is it?
It's not like the most glamorous
a Leicester
kind of
barmaid.
By the way, if you live in Leicester, we do like you.
There's nothing unglamorous about Leicester.
And there were sort of these accusations moving around off the scene, and that is exactly what the problem was. So Ponting was very explicit about everything. With Gatting, there were all these accusations. No one really knew what was going on. And the TCCB, as the ECB then was, actually found this very threatening. They banned Gatting's autobiography from being published. Sold in any bank, which in itself is an extraordinary thing.
It's a truly extraordinary move, isn't it? I mean, it's sort of a Stalinist approach to a cricketer's autobiography.
This was in the early 90s. It's very of its time, because frankly, you could just go down to W.H. Smith and buy it. Mm. And they decided that banning it from County Grounds would mean that nothing, no content of it
and
was
I'm
ever
sure
let out.
Boosted sales.
But these accusations about Gatting and this northern barmaid. Midlands, Northern, it's all geographically hazy around Leicester. these accusations about Gatting and the barmaid, the point was that they were undefined and that they came at the height of his powers. It wasn't as if he was someone who was able to be rehabilitated. Mm. And the TCCB found this slightly worrying, stripped him of his captaincy. He wasn't someone that was going somewhere and this was a stop off on the road. He was someone that was England captain.
I guess you have
should
that
have
trade off, don't you? With Ricky Ponting, you felt, you've got all this potential, and maybe the TCCB made the decision, well, actually, we haven't got this potential. And now you're taking us to another England cricketer who, slightly less portly than Gats.
But pretty portly now. Now he's been working on the weights, and I'm sure you've all heard about his bout in the ring, Freddie Flintoff. Quite a transformation. He said that his victory in boxing this week was better than winning the Ashes in 2005.
Did he?
At which point...
Are you sure he said that?
I am certain he did. I heard it from his own mouth. And not via the medium of YouTube, which kind of lessened my respect for him slightly. But there was, of course, the infamous Fred Lowe influence in the World Cup in 2007.
Yeah.
And at which point we've slightly forgotten what year that was. I'm sure it was 2000.
I think it was earlier than 2000. Anyway, never mind.
The Fred Lowe, we all know the Fred Lowe incident. And what was interesting here was that it was... Andrew Flintoff, on his own, got drunk during a tournament, went out, stole a pedalo, went boating around a boat lake, came back, probably had a very good time. Why it's a problem, I mean, we all do that kind of thing all the time. But what's interesting is that it should have been a very personal thing, but I was reading a quite interesting interview with Michael Vaughan, who said that the effect on the squad was huge. Not least because the authorities, because this was all over the press, and the authorities all thought... we need to crack down on the England squad because they're all like this. And so that all of their sort of freedom was restricted. But what's interesting with Flintoff is that I don't think his reputation really suffered. So Peterson with these texts has just come across as an arrogant idiot who's pretty unfaithful to his captain and his team. With Flintoff, he lost the vice captaincy, but frankly, who really cares? He's vice captain, and he was banned for a game. And as I remember it, not a particularly important game during the World Cup. But it was looked on pretty lenient. I know we've talked about this.
I think the issue with Flintoff is that his popularity in 2005 came from two things. Firstly, astonishing performances. But secondly, a real sense that he was a man of the people. You know, he almost looked and spoke like a man of the people, and that led his popularity. And somehow, getting drunk on a pedalo fed into that idea, fed into that image. I do think, actually, it's something it was right to be very critical of, actually. I mean, England performed dismally in that particular World Cup, and having their talismanic player treating the tournament in that respect, you know, clearly didn't help. But it's a very interesting example of how the media will treat different individuals differently.
And I think you put your finger on something quite important when you talk about the sort of cult of personality that surrounds particular players. And one, Flintoff was able to, I don't know if he sort of span it deliberately, but it was to his advantage. And to Gabe, you accuse me of talking too much about Arthur Carr, who was captain of Notts in England.
Warning, listeners, if you think you've heard the story before, you have.
Well, no, that's not true, actually, because I'm going to go for a different story now. This whole thing of being a sort of larger-than-life character off the field and therefore being able to command respect on the field is quite interesting, because Arthur Carr was essentially an alcoholic. And he got absolutely hammered the night before a game at some point and had a hangover so bad that he had double vision the next morning. At which point he went straight to the Pavilion Bar and downed three whiskey and sodas before going out to see the ball perfectly and score a double century. Now, we don't recommend this at home, but it's interesting that...
Was there media coverage of this? I mean, sorry, would fans have been aware of this at the time, or is this one of those stories that's been passed down in folklore?
Not at the time, I don't think. I think it has become... But the team was very aware of it. I think this is the point. There are two different things we're dealing with here, one of which is public image and one of which is image within the team. Ponting, I think, gained a lot of respect from his team, who were well aware that he was essentially an alcoholic when he was younger. He turned himself around and he used the talent that he evidently had, and when he was a disciplinarian, it wasn't just because he was a boring bastard, although he probably was as well. It wasn't just that, it was because he actually wanted to win and he realised what needed to be to win. And with Arthur Carr, it was sort of the same, because they realised that he wasn't just doing things for the sake, because he was a dour leader.
I wonder if you've got this two-tier then between players like Ponting, who reached this crisis point and thought, I have to change, and in a way, players like Flintoff and Carr, who almost, it was part of their persona. Mm. It was this idea that they could be both the heavy drinker, heavy partier, and the player. And I mean, both of them very much fits that mould. I think there are stories around his famous Headingley innings that he was not actually, he was slightly the worse for wear when he played that. And maybe it's that difference between the players who have their crisis point and change, and the players who kind of live with their sins as such.
To the book review, and this episode we are looking at Akash Chopra's Out of the Blue, Rajasthan's Road to the Ranji.
Akash Chopra played 10 tests for India in the mid-2000s with sort of fairly limited success, finishing with his kind of mid-20s average. But he's actually built himself something of a reputation as a writer, blogging regularly on Crick Info and writing a couple of books. This is a pretty unusual book for our podcast. Indian domestic cricket seems a very odd topic to focus on, a very niche topic, but it's a book that's about much, much more than the Ranji Trophy. Chopra is blessed here with a fairy tale story. Rajasthan are the unloved, unliked almost team of Indian cricket, and in this year, the 2010 season, they win the Ranji Trophy, the high prize of Indian cricket. They go from being the worst team to being the best team. It's a great fairy tale story. It gets even better because this fairy tale starts with Chopra being dropped from the Delhi side and finding out by that from a newspaper. So it's got this wonderful kind of narrative arc to it. The book has got a rather peculiar format. The first half of the book is basically a series of mini-biographies, and you get Chopra does a sort of little pen portrait of each of his Rajasthan teammates. And if I kind of sort of describe that, it doesn't sound like the most exciting format. But actually, we spend so much of our time, I mean, you know, on this podcast, all of us as cricket fans, talking about glamorous cricketers, talking about the well-paid, the successful. This is a book primarily about the vast majority of professional cricketers.
It is. What I found very readable about this book is that we've done a few books that are about club county cricketers, essentially. The one that springs to mind initially is Simon Hughes'
A Lot of Hard Yakka,
which is the life of a Middlesex team in the 90s. But what was I found so readable about this book, and you pointed out that, I mean, it's... Bits of it are pretty badly written, it has to be said. But there are bits of it where the
Chopra loves
where the cliche is just...
The highlight involves two separate players coming to the party in one page.
That's a big party. That's a significant party. But what I found really immediately grabbing about the book was the fact that it really forces you to... Sorry, a bookcase is about to fall on me. It really forces you to rethink the way that people relate to cricket. Because I always had this idea that if you're a good player, you kind of go to school, you're good. You get picked by a county, you go to their youth team, and you sort of work through the ranks. But the sort of tortuous relationship that a lot of these players have with cricket... Chopra is the first, so he as you say, at the beginning of the book, he gets dropped and starts, and then plays Rajasthan on the back of that. But all of this first section, which is all about the biographies of the team within the...
And it's fascinating, because you read the odd one and you think, God, this player's had a tough career. And then you suddenly realise, they all have. Mm. There's not a single one who's had a straightforward career progression. And I think, in a way, it's quite revealing, because we do think of these prodigies making their way through the ranks, but actually, in reality, they come with a host of rejections. The other thing I think worth noting, and I think we do sometimes forget... I think some of us have this idea, you know, oh, maybe if we'd tried a bit harder, I personally don't, we could have made it at the top level. The amount of dedication is astonishing. It gives you a clear gap between the club cricketer and the serious cricketer. Deepak Chahar, the seamer, who claims 8 for 10, you know, great figures that, in their opening game, spent 16 hours a day training as a teenager. And it puts in perspective the extent to which cricket has to become your life.
I spend 16 hours a day sleeping, if I can, so that's that. You've
consequently become very good at it as a result.
There's also the remarkable story of Pankaj Singh, who is a seamer, is a volleyball player turned seamer, and the story of his very tortuous relationship with cricket, and he goes off and to work at a gym in order to try and become a cricketer, earning an absolute pittance, and then can't do that, so tries to do the same for volleyball, again can't do that. And the way that people's lives are made or lost by their relationship with cricket is...
And I think we forget again the fact that having cricket as a profession comes with its difficulties. I mean, there's a really difficult story about Vinit Saxena.
Great, as long as you're not part of it.
Chopra's opening batsman, who is forced to support his family after the death of both his father and then his two-year-old daughter. He plays with them the day of the death of his two-year-old daughter. And you think, well, this is a kind of less glamorous side. I mean, if this is cricketers who... Cricket is how they put bread on the table, then suddenly the sport doesn't become about, you know, glamour and millions and fame. It becomes about, you know, a paycheck, and it's interesting.
But ultimately, do you think this is... So, a few weeks ago, we looked at Out of the Ashes, which is the story of the Afghanistan team, who, you know, many of you... Obviously the sort of difficulties of the team are completely different and on a completely different scale. But do you get the sense with Chopra? So, Out of the Ashes is very much a sort of a story of... hope fulfilled, and at the end it's all very feel good, etc, etc. Do you think that it's the same with this book, that you get to the end and with the winning, so essentially it's about a team winning the Ranji trophy, and the second half of the book is actually mostly talking about
match reports
from the way that they won that trophy, actually remarkably easily in the end. Mm. But so do you get to the end and you think, oh, it's all worth it? And all of these people who have toiled so much through the first half of the book, suddenly do you sort of think that they're sort of being vindicated?
Well, I think it's a rather wonderful team of underdogs. You know, it's an underdog team filled with individual underdogs. You know, these players have all had very difficult careers, generally. And somehow they all come good. And you also wonder the extent to which maybe you have to have been through a certain amount as a player. I mean, mentally, the fact that someone like, going back to Deepak Chahar, the seamer, he was told by Greg Chappell when he was, I didn't know this, but when Greg Chappell was in charge of Rajasthan cricket briefly, he was told, you have no future, you're too small to be a cricketer. Would Chahar have gone away to the gym and worked as hard as he did without that? You know, maybe this passage of rejection is what creates cricketers. I mean, Chopra, as well, he's an opening batsman, a very successful opening batsman, and he, I think he has some quite interesting, very honest reflections on the game. His highlight, and really maybe one of the highlights of the book, is when he makes this massive triple hundred that wins them a crucial game. And he says, as I walked back to the pavilion, I felt a peace descend on me. And it was interesting because, I mean, firstly, this is almost kind of religious language, isn't it? You know, it's almost this sense of being at peace with self-hope. And it's not almost about happiness, is it? It's not about being ecstatic or delighted. It's this sense of peace is quite an interesting way of phrasing it.
When you, maybe I'm being cynical, I usually am cynical, but when you read it in the context of the book, you do think maybe this is just as clumsy rhetoric, and there is quite a lot of clumsy rhetoric in the,
but
in
I wonder, I don't
out.
Think I think there's a difference between he's not the greatest of writers, but he has a sharpness, I think he has an ability to understand the game as a professional, which not all professionals do. And I thought maybe the interesting thing behind the reference was the fact that actually a lot of times as a professional batsman you're so under pressure to perform that the moments when you perform almost aren't celebrations, they're just relief.
And you learned something specifically about the way to get out of a bad pattern.
Well, this is fascinating, and good news maybe for all club cricketers who can't be bothered to train. Chopra swears by this bit of advice that Ricky Ponting, who keeps coming up in this episode, appropriately so.
His ghost is haunting us.
But Ponting once told Chopra that when you're going through a lean patch, it's not a bad idea to go into a match slightly underprepared. And his logic was, if you spend too much time in the net, you go into the game with a kind of false confidence. Because in a net, you know, your edges, the edges don't bother you as much, that kind of thing. And it was an interesting idea that occasionally the kind of conventional logic behind training needs to be rethought. I mean, is it a great idea? Does it get you into form if you go into nets and just swing at everything and middle the odd ball? I mean, perhaps not. But I think we'd heartily recommend this book. It's an unusual read, and as well as being an interesting insight into the life of difficult lives of some ordinary cricketers, it's also quite a fascinating insight into Indian cricket as a whole. To the interview, and this week we were joined by Samir Chopra. Samir is the author of Crick Info's The Pitch blog. He's also just released his first ever cricket book, Brave New Pitch, The Evolution of Modern Cricket. He is also Professor of Philosophy at City University of New York. I began by asking Samir about the inspiration behind the new book.
In this case, I should be honest and say that the idea for the book really came from my editor at HarperCollins, V.K. Karthika, who, you know, I had actually pitched another book to her, which was sort of a memoir along the lines of, this is how I used to watch cricket and think about cricket when I was back in India. Then, you know, life changed. I migrated, went to the U.S., and how my sort of watching of cricket changed over the years in terms of my changing politics. And Karthika was also kind of, you know, and both she and I were talking about this book, and we also were sort of struck by the fact that the game of cricket was changing so much, even as we were talking about, you know, fans changing experiences of the game. And I was noticing, and, you know, this is back in 2009, 2010, that my perception of the game was changing a lot just because of, you know, the introduction of 2020. I'm pretty old school, you know, nation-based test cricket fan, and I found it hard to really reconcile myself to the changing landscape in many ways. But I could see that the game was being changed in ways that were interesting. It was giving a chance for more players to make a living from playing the game. There was a chance for the game to spread in interesting ways over the globe because of the T20 League.
So I wondered, I mean, there are so many points already you've just raised, but I think particularly maybe that point on the associates is a really interesting one to follow up on. I mean, do you think cricket should look to be evangelical? I mean, should cricket, is it kind of a responsibility of the ICC to look to spread the game? Or is it perhaps something that we just kind of wait for other countries to pick it up if they're interested, if they so desire?
You know, I think that's a very good question. I think this is one area where my thinking about the game has changed radically. I used to be the kind of person that 5 years ago, if you had asked me about the expansion of the game, I would have said, no, just keep it where it is, keep it as a small club, and just improve the standard of cricket in the number of countries that play, you know, top-class cricket. I didn't even like to see the associates play in the World Cup many years ago. But I think now, the more I think about it, and the more I think about the viability of the game, and in fact, the more I think about the quality of the game, you know, and what a fun game cricket is to play, it now strikes me that the right attitude for the ICC to take is to promote the game, is to find ways to spread the game beyond its traditional borders. And personally, I don't just think it's a responsibility of the ICC. I think it's also the responsibility of all of us that follow the game to actually pay more attention to the game elsewhere. I mean, I'm guilty of not having paid attention to associate cricket in the past. I still find it hard to get myself excited about following cricket in obscure, you know, in sort of obscure venues. And one of the reasons why I like the idea of the T20 League, whether it's the IPL, whether it's an international Premier League that comes up down the line, or whether it'll be smaller 2020 leagues, is that it might give a chance for cricket players in non-traditional cricket countries to think about possibly making a career out of playing cricket, and actually that contributing to the spread of the game worldwide. I mean,
because
I think this...
you no longer need a successful national team. You, if you're good enough as an individual, you can win a contract.
That's right.
Wondered with your sort of, particularly your US knowledge, what your thoughts are on... I mean, the US for such a long time has been regarded as kind of the great promised land of cricket. I mean, if cricket could only crack the US. And I wondered what your thoughts are on the prospect of that ever happening.
You know, it's interesting. I have a small section in my book about the possibilities of cricket taking off in the US, and I write about it in a very different way from the way that I think most people concentrating on development in American cricket do. My sort of analysis of this is a little bit different from what people have. My impression is that cricket has suffered in the U.S. because Americans associate it with being an English game, and there is something, you know, there is something hopelessly archaic or old-fashioned that they view as being sort of irredeemably associated with the game. You know, it's a game played in whites, and, you know, the way the game is depicted in the media is this very sort of geriatric game played by, you know, by these landed types, and it seems very sedate and, you know, boring and sort of a, you know, sort of a throwback to a time that America has moved on from. And I think in some ways the fact that the 2020 League, based as it is in India, or if it is supported by a large expat community that wants to see that version of the game in the States, has very good promise for sparking off promotion of the game. The actual problems that cricket is facing right now in the U.S., you know, right down at the nitty-gritty grassroots level, are problems that have to do with dysfunctional administration. I mean, hopelessly dysfunctional administration. I think there's lots of people that have written about this far more.
There's been some really interesting coverage on that, actually. And, I mean, but do you think there is a capacity issue as well? I mean, just the fact that... because I've struck in my experience in the U.S. by the fact that there's an incredible passion for sport there. I mean, it dominates the national the media in a way that even I don't think we in the U.K. can even compare to. But I just wondered whether you felt it's almost a saturated market, that the extent to which the NFL, the NBA are already there, or do you think there is still room for it?
I tend to agree with you that there is a little bit of a problem of saturation when you consider that. You know, I mean, when you look at the big three of American sports, you know, football, basketball, and baseball, the distance between those leagues and the leagues that follow is huge. And it tells me that even fairly popular sports like ice hockey and soccer have a hard time making, you know, that kind of impact on the American sporting scene. But on the other hand, you know, they're big enough to, you know, to, you know, to pay reasonable living wages to their players and to, and, you know, to provide them with, you know, sports as a professional pursuit. I do think the level of interest in sports in the US is such that cricket could make an impact, and cricket could make an impact, you know, just in some small, you know, in some small enclaves. But that might be all that you need in order to, you know, make cricket into a professionally viable sport. You know, you might not get multimillionaires playing cricket, but you might get enough money in cricket that, you know, somebody who's interested in playing cricket in college and then wants to continue with it might actually think of it as a, might actually think of it as a reasonable career.
No, you make a really interesting point, because I suppose something like soccer in the US has never taken off to the same extent, but they're still able to support professional clubs.
Yeah.
I mean, go to see the Red Bulls play just outside New York City, and they have a nice stadium, and, you know, they have a, you know, they have all the trappings of, you know, of a major league soccer team. They've got fan clubs, and, you know, there's a party in the parking lot, and there's, and it's a very nice stadium. So, you know, it's not Manchester United, and you don't have players making $4 million a year. Well, you know, you have one, you know, star player. But you know, there's so much money in American sport that even if you aren't the most successful league, all you need to get is a small slice of the pie in order for the game to become professionally viable.
No, I think that's a really interesting point. I think we often think of it too in a too sort of binary way. You either crack the market or you don't. I just wonder, rewinding again right to the start, I think it was a really interesting phrase you used. You said you'd found it very difficult to reconcile yourself to kind of watching cricket in its newest form. And I wondered if you found that, whether your experience, because I noticed you've written on how you've become more comfortable with, for example, the World 2020, and I wondered whether you found yourself maybe more reconciled to the game as it's become.
I think, look, you know, like many other people, I was brought up on a diet of international cricket. To me, cricketing rivalry means, you know, nation-based rivalry. You know, the real cricket has been test cricket, you know, but I slowly got used to, you know, one day international cricket. I've gotten used to international T20 cricket. I mean, though I have to admit, I still find it hard to get excited about these mini T20 series.
Sure.
But I don't mind, you know, like the World Cup in T20. It's a, you know, it's something to get excited about. I have, though, also, I think in the last 2-3 years, and I think this is reflected in my book, I've really started to think a lot about the negative effects of having cricket built around a nation-based structure. And I divide these concerns into two parts. One is, you know, the larger problem of having sports infected with a certain kind of nationalist sentiment, which I think often leads to a lot of very dispiriting sort of xenophobic discourse surrounding the game, you know, between fans, you know, between journalists and fans, between cricketers, you know, these standard accusations that you hear of, you know, the English are whingers, the Aussies are racist, the Americans, you know, the Indians are whiners, and, you know, the Pakistanis are cheats. And it's just like, you know, as a fan, you read that and you just go a little numb because you're sick and tired of reading this sort of endless bickering all the time. And sometimes you wonder if, you know, maybe playing at a club level might at least take that aspect out of it. You know, sometimes it doesn't happen.
I think it's a really interesting point. I mean, I often find it fascinating whenever I'm looking at cricket videos on YouTube, how often the debate underneath, whatever the video will generate into an India versus Pakistan sort of brawl. But then at the same time, I've been lucky enough to watch an England-Australia game. I've never had the fortune to watch an India-Pakistan game, and I'm mad, live at least, and I imagine the atmosphere and the passion present is something that I guess only nationalistic sentiment could produce.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, I think the one concern is, you know, whether that's the only way in which we can organize cricket and sort of, you know, resign ourselves to this sort of, you know, to the negative aspects of nationalism that sort of seem to go with it, or whether it might be possible, for instance, to organize the game at the club level, you know, much in the way that soccer is done, and, you know, find a way to perhaps diffuse some of that excessive nationalist sentiment, right? Now, that might be a kind of a forlorn hope, to be honest, because even when I look at club soccer, I still notice the same old nationalist divisions in play. You know, people are still, you know, there's, you know, there's still a lot of, you know, worries about racism, for example, in, you know.
I guess that's particularly relevant at the moment within the Premier League, that the issue of racism, but.
Yeah, and, you know, and then, you know, when things really go bad, will local fans turn on the imported player because he wasn't loyal enough to the home team? You know, things like that. So I'm not sure if that's going to go away with clubs. But I think the other more important factor that I started to think about was that a national team has 11 players in it, which means that only 11 players from a country can play the highest form of the game. And perhaps by organizing the game around club level, we might be able to give more players a chance to play the game at the highest level of the game, because in fact now they're not competing in this local sort of labor market, which says, you know, 11 players maximum, and you know, the rest of you all can just keep on competing for the limited number of international spots. But in fact, we might have a kind of a more open system where we have international clubs. So rather than simply looking to national sides to pick you, you could be looking at sides that are not based in your home country, and you could travel elsewhere to play. So in that sense, cricket's employment and labor market would become, you know, like a labor market, much like many others, where you don't just think, well, you know, the only place where I can work is my country. You know, you can look elsewhere. I mean, I'm an expat. I mean, sure.
I mean, do you think it's a fascinating kind of a really sort of brave new world scenario? And I wondered whether, I mean, do you envisage maybe a balance, perhaps, say the IPL grows to a stage where maybe it's almost, it sort of splits the calendar as such. You've got the IPL season, you've got the international season, and they kind of coexist comfortably. Because I guess at the moment, it's a very awkward arrangement. There's a sense of almost every week of the calendar is kind of fought over. And I wondered whether you could envisage a scenario where you have club cricket and international cricket both existing comfortably with each other, or whether you think one has to have dominance over the other.
No, I think that, you know, I think a balance could be found. And, you know, I'm actually, you know, there's a part of me that's optimistic about this, that we could find the kind of balance so that the international calendar could be shrunk to more manageable size, and we could leave part of the calendar free for these kinds of T20 leagues, which could actually be, you know, the kinds of sellers of cricket in some sense. You know, just like one day international cricket subsidized test cricket and actually brought new fans to the game, T20 leagues could do the same. And in fact, T20 leagues have even greater potential because they might be able to sell the game in actually non-traditional markets. So, I mean, I have this sense of optimism that in fact the emergence of the T20 league, which, you know, I think a lot of people think it could just cannibalize international cricket. I don't think it has to do that. I think it has to be given, you know, for example, you know, people talk about the IPL getting its own season slot in the international calendar. And I think, sure, I think that would be a great idea, because that would reduce contention with boards that aren't happy about their players going off to play in the IPL. But I think the moment that's done, then you should treat the IPL like an international tournament. And, you know, and the IPL maybe could be expanded. I don't see why we might not have, you know, like a global T20 competition in the way that we have, you know, the rugby tri-nations.
Where, sure.
You
know, and there does seem to be a difficulty with it at present that I certainly know from a UK perspective, it continues to be seen, despite the involvement of a lot of English players, it continues to be seen very much as an Indian tournament, which is unfortunate, I think, given the quality on show. If I could just change the subject slightly, I was very keen to ask, one thing that very much sets you apart as a writer, I think, is the fact that you do have this unique background as a professor of philosophy. And I wondered whether you see a connection in the work you do, or what, do you see a connection in the work you do with philosophy and the writing you do on cricket, or are these very much kind of separate fields? Do you kind of, the cricket is a hobby away from your academic work, or would you, do you feel there's an explicit connection between the two?
I think there's one, I think there's a couple of explicit connections at least. I think one is that I perhaps spend, you know, I do spend a lot of time, I think, thinking about these various facets of the game that are, you know, the nationalism that's in the game, the economics of the game. I spend quite a few pages in the book talking about how I think players need to be treated more fairly, you know, as professionals. And I think perhaps there's a kind of a critical aspect of my, you know, of my following of cricket that perhaps comes from my academic background, you know, which is used to sort of, you know, taking on these, you know, taking on these bodies of text and sort of evaluating them to see how much sense they make. And I think at one point I used to just take on cricket very uncritically. You know, well, I'm a fan, I enjoy it, you know, and I'm sort of happy to see my team win. But I think perhaps being a philosopher or being, you know, being an academic maybe just enables me to step back once in a while and to sort of be more reflective about it. You know, as a philosopher, you also tend to think about the various aspects of the game. You know, I wrote something that I haven't published yet on cricket, you know, which is about the aesthetics of the game. I published a paper with a friend of mine, Dave Cody, who's also a philosopher out in Tasmania, about the ethics of certain cricketing practices. So, you know, I think cricket's cricket's a domain of human interaction, and any domain of human interaction is of philosophical interest. You know, how do people resolve conflicts? How do they behave with each other? What are the politics of the various interactions of the field? And of course, cricket's fascinating because it's, you know, it's made up of these countries that have a kind of a common history, but they're very diverse in their own ways. You know, so for a philosopher, it's kind of a fascinating sort of field to look at. And
do you think it offers more than, this is a slightly difficult question to answer, but do you think it offers more for a philosopher to kind of get into than other sports? I mean, I've just always had the sense that cricket writers just seem to have more available to them, almost like more to explore than perhaps football writers might do.
I agree. You know, the test match especially, I think, is what brings this out, because it's extended, segmented action. It has a kind of a narrative ebb and flow. It has a very dramatic staging. You know, the field setup. It has a kind of a beauty of its own. It has sort of so many contours. You know, the game starts in a particular way, and then it progresses over 5 days. So you have a sense of, you know, the battle engaged, and it just begs for metaphors to be applied to it, that are brought in from art, from drama, from theater, from warfare, from the corporate boardroom. I don't know, but I think it's the length of this encounter that just makes it such a fertile place, you know, for us to exercise our imaginations.
To the debate, in this episode we are asking whether the rise of the cricket-playing millionaire is a cause for celebration. Can I just clarify at this point that when I saw the rise of the cricket-playing millionaire, which was a topic that Andy suggested, I thought this was people who owned large country houses in England playing cricket. And I said, yeah, I'll oppose that happily. But he said, no, it's actually people like Sachin Tendulkar getting paid for what they do and becoming millionaires. So I'm opposing something that I wasn't, until about 2 minutes ago, quite sure what I was going to face, but we're going to go.
It sounds like you're getting your excuses in very early.
No, I'm not going to get. Basically, what I'm doing here is making sure that when you are crying in a corner in about 5 minutes' time, it looks all the more impressive. So the debate is the rise of the cricket playing millionaire is a cause for celebration, which Mr. Ryan is going to propose.
I think we spend a lot of our time as a society kind of hand-wringing over the amount of money that sportsmen get paid. But it's worth considering, particularly in the context of cricket, actually, that for a long, long time in cricket's history, players were not paid well. And it left them, firstly, having to often struggle to make a living, balance it with other jobs. It often left them very poorly equipped for after their career to support their families. And finally, it also meant that other sports perhaps could have a kind of greater pull. And all these things, I think, are now being addressed by the game. I think it's vital that cricket pays well in order to make sure that youngsters who are talented in several sports, as they often are, don't come to the conclusion, I'll play this because it's better paid. They can still select cricket because the money is there and it's available. The cricket-playing millionaire connects very, very strongly with this idea of player power as well. And we consistently get this idea that player power is such a bad thing, that it's not a positive. I think player power is broadly a good thing. I think it's right that players have a bit more independence, a bit more freedom, and they're not in a position where they can be bossed around by clubs, bossed around as easily by associations. I think the other thing as well here to celebrate is the fact that ultimately cricket's being seen
that these cricketers who then make this money are able to then go on with their finances and do exciting things and interesting things beyond the game. That they can take on these roles that other sportsmen in other big games have beyond the game, where they can become these kind of statesmen, dedicating their money, perhaps to charitable causes, perhaps just back within the game.
There are some absolutely extraordinary arguments in there. The first being that one should pay cricketers better, because therefore you start a bidding war effectively with other sports. Trying to start a bidding war between cricket and football is exactly the wrong way to try and attract...
Bidding war is your phrase, not mine.
Well, no, it is. That's exactly what you were saying. You were saying that you had to pay cricket as well so that you could attract them away from football, because if football paid better, then they would go and do football. That is exactly a bidding war. It's saying, we're playing better, you have to come and play for us. And actually, I think that's disingenuous on two grounds. One of which is that when people decide between... Unless you're Gary Neville, who played both sports to quite a high level, you actually decide between the two before actually you have a really particularly good idea of which one pays better than the other. And secondly, that you... I've completely forgotten my second point. Oh, secondly, that a bidding war between football and cricket is always going to lose. And if you set up the relationship on those terms, then you are inevitably...
Okay, firstly, let's address this point of bidding war, because it was not my phrase, it was your phrase. And the key point to get across it is I was not proposing, and at no point said, cricket should outpay football or outcompete football. What is important is that it's at least put on a comparable spectrum.
But
so the idea,
but
for example...
The relative wealth of... And it is completely disingenuous in these terms to compare cricket and football, unless you say that the IPL is the template for cricket. And it is not. The majority of ways that people get into cricket happens through counties in England. I mean, to take the England example, happens through counties which pay... Compared to... So if you take the average salary of someone who plays first-class cricket as against a Premiership footballer, they are going to be so completely different that I think to actually say we have to compare them in order to have, you know, in order for people to then make choices between them is just on a high end to absolutely nothing. You also said that paying players better would give them more, quotes, player power. Now, if there is one sport that has a complete lack of player power, it is football. In football, the players are bought and sold by teams. They are bought and sold by teams with far less say than they are in cricket. And that is because, in football, the money is everything between whether... If a team needs money, it'll sell a player. In cricket, because the money doesn't really come into it, it means that there is much less emphasis on the team to actually do that. And it relies... I mean, there is no... The old thing about, you know, Michael Vaughan played for a particular county because he was born in that county. Well, no, he didn't. He went across to another county, played for that county, and there was a massive ruckus about it. Wayne Rooney went across to Man U because Man U could pay for him, could pay his wages, because he was paid so much that they were the only team that could pay for him, and Everton couldn't pay for him. So the idea that paying players more gives them more player power is completely ridiculous.
Firstly, I think in football in particular, I don't want to turn this into a debate about football because this is a fine, splendid cricketing podcast, but player power in football manifests itself in a very important way, which is that players are at a stage where they can effectively demand transfers from clubs very, very successfully. And once they, for example, say, I'm no longer happy here, it becomes almost impossible for clubs to keep them. It becomes very difficult because of the cost.
So they can hold clubs to ransom.
They can hold clubs to ransom. But the issue I'm saying here as well... The issue here I'm saying as well... No, the issue I'm saying as well, though, is that... Let's remember, and this is actually something that is true in both cricket and football's history, that there was an era where clubs held total power, where they could treat their players not particularly well, who could pay them not particularly well, because there was almost, especially actually within football, but I think this existed pretty much within cricket as well, a cartel between the clubs. They would agree effectively on what players would be played. And that environment was not, it didn't treat players well, and it gave the clubs an unhealthy amount of power. And actually, a world where players are able to dictate terms better, I think is often better for cricket.
But they're only dictating terms on the basis of the wages that are paid, that clubs are willing to pay for them.
Ah, but it's more than that.
Their worth isn't independent of the club. The club pays them. The club decides how much they are worth to them, and therefore gives them the wage. That is not power that's invested in the player. That's power that's invested in the club that has a wealthy enough backer to then be able to play.
But power to effectively choose where you go and choose where you play. I mean, this leads into
this is all getting incredibly metaphysical for a Sunday evening.
Well, maybe this concept of player power is difficult, but the idea that, for example, an international federation now has to work to keep its players on side, I don't think is necessarily a terrible idea. The fact that, for example, the West Indies needed to hack out a settlement with Chris Gayle, I don't think is the worst idea ever. There needs to be a balance, obviously, and I don't think you want a system whereby players treat their international federation with disrespect. But there does need to be a bit of give and take here, because we've got to look back on that for the long periods of time. And England in the 90s, by the way, is a classic example of this. They treated players terribly, and they treated them as disposable, and this links very well into what we were talking about with Mark Ramprakash in the last episode, the way players were almost expendable constantly. And an era where you're forced, as a national federation, to demand a player's respect almost, to manage that player well, I think is a positive era.
Yeah, I think this is where we need to go back to the subject of the debate was the rise of the cricket-playing millionaire is a cause for celebration. And where I would argue about this is the idea of a millionaire. Yes, no one's disputing that you have to respect the players that play for you, or indeed that you have to pay them a proper wage. But the idea that people should be millionaires.
Do you object to the fact that in the IPL, Kevin Peterson go out there for a few weeks and make £1 million?
No.
Is that objectionable to you?
No.
Okay. So then, what is objectionable to you about this motion? If you agree with that as a premise,
it is a cause for celebration within the game more widely. So there is a difference. There is a difference between so the IPL is something that is founded on money.
Mm.
The IPL is all about money, full stop, yeah. End off. It's not really about cricket, it's about money. It's about a way of creating money. And it is a very, very dangerous way of running the game more widely. If the entirety of the game was run by the IPL,
okay,
cricket would not exist.
But I think we can find some common. I think we can probably find some common ground with that. I think the issue, though,
you know what? You always know you've won when your opposition tries to find common ground.
But the issue I think that you've just agreed with me on, which I think is an absolutely crucial one, and really the point I was trying to make, was the fact that a lot of cricket fans find it distasteful, the contracts that are awarded in the IPL. And you and I, and I'm actually quite surprised that you've agreed with me on that, but you and I have both said that actually we don't. I don't find it distasteful when these players get awarded these multi-million pound contracts to the IPL.
It's ridiculous to say that about it. It's like saying, the Pope believes in God. I mean, get over it. You have a foundation that's... You have a league that is based on money. People get paid a lot to play in it. Get over it. I mean, it happens. But what I'm saying is that it is a very, very dangerous model for the rest of cricket to say that effectively you should be able to buy and sell cricketers in the same way that you... And I think we've seen a lot of the same problems. Football and cricket are not comparable in any way whatsoever in the way that they're set up. But I think you've seen a lot of the problems of the way it happens in football. And I think that...
Why would more of an open market in the buying and selling of cricketers be such a bad thing?
No, it's not about there being an open market. It's about the fact that if you ultimately, the be-all and end-all, I'm not quite sure how long this has gone on for already, because we could potentially go on all night. But it's not about the open market in the buying and selling of cricketers. It's about the fact that you ultimately, the way that cricket works is that cricket, and we've talked about it in this book, is that you, with cricketers, you have a, and I don't know about football as well as you do, but with cricketers, if you suddenly have a few people who are paid absolutely millions of the kind of highly traded stars within the leagues, if you like, that suddenly there becomes such a disparity between the system that the whole thing becomes completely untenable, because what you have is effectively a return to the professional and amateur setup that you had in cricket in the past, where you had some people who were bought for their skills, traded between as assets between clubs, and then the rest of the people who were sort of padding in
the
team.
But the divide between the cricketing haves and have-nots isn't new. I mean, go back to Grace. I mean, it's not... The idea that there will always be cricketers who are the superstars making a lot of money and the kind of the admirable but inevitably journeymen who aren't, it is, I think, an inevitable part of the game. No one's arguing in favour, I think, of salary equality. And I think, actually, if the people at the top are going to do well, they might as well do very well. And I think it's probably for the benefit of cricket as a whole as they do.
It is, but as long as it's not made a part of the system. One-off, if someone wants to pay, if a Packer figure wants to pay someone millions of pounds to go and play for them, fine.
Do join us here on Reverse Web Radio in a couple of weeks' time when Christmas will come early and we'll be looking back at the year and forward to the next.